Blog Talk Radio.
Good Sunday evening. It is 7 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm your host, Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend a part of your evening with me. We've got a great show for you tonight, including segments on the economy and the fiscal cliff. Then we're going to talk about how the gun argument continues in the wake of Sandy Hook. And we're going to have a special update from me on Republican strategy and whether the GOP is up to something. That and our trademark Hall of Fame and Shame on tonight's show. But before I get into all of that, I want to give you, my listeners, and those who will listen to the archive of the show, a special note of thanks for making my show as successful as it is. The size of the audience has grown considerably over the 2 months the show has been in operation. Interest in the show and the blog for the show, and in particular the Facebook page for the show, has really exploded. According to Facebook statistics, the page for the show has been seen by over 100,000 people in December, and at any time, nearly 1,000 people are talking about the show. So again, thank you all very much for your support. At any time during the show, if you want to call in and talk with me, please do so. The call-in number for the show is 917-889-3891. So let's get started, though. And first up, I want to discuss whether the Republican Party is up to something. 4 years ago, in December of 2008, while Democrats were celebrating the victory of the election, Republicans were gathering together, meeting to decide how they were going to play the next couple of years. Now, there were several high-level meetings, in December of 2008, between Republican elected officials, and included were members of think tanks like FreedomWorks and Americans for Prosperity. They were meeting because they, meaning Republicans, had just gotten trounced in the 2008 elections. They lost the presidency. They lost seats in the House and the Senate, both of which would be controlled by Democrats in the next session. But even worse than the election defeat was the poor favorability rating the public gave Republicans. About 60% of Americans in December of 2008 had an unfavorable view of the Republican Party. The GOP's favorability was threatening to go south of 30%. That, by the way, is exactly where Republican favorability stands today. 60% unfavorable and 31% favorable. Back in 2008, Republicans had a choice to make. Would they moderate their party in response to this historic level of unpopularity they had with the American public? Or would they double down on the same radical right-wing agenda that caused this low level of favorability in the first place? Now, they wanted to double down and go right, but as they discussed this in their December meetings, they realized that they couldn't do that, at least not directly. The country was already pretty sick of what Republicans had to offer. Now, after a few hours of discussion, some back and forth, some arguing, they came up with the idea of fronting a third group, have that third group claim it was distinct from the Republican Party, but have that group attack President-elect Obama's initiatives. I later wrote that various Republican interest groups and think tanks had started to spend in December 2008 and continued for the better part of 2 years presidential election campaign level amounts of money on organizing and promoting that third group, which came to be known as the Tea Party. Indeed, from December 2008 to December 2009, various Republican-leaning groups spent nearly $100 million on organizing and promoting the Tea Party. Now, while Democrats were busy disengaging their advocacy and campaign effort in the wake of a successful election result, Republicans were building up the infrastructure of what would be a sophisticated AstroTurf fake grassroots movement designed to impede President Obama's initiative and take back the Congress in 2010. 4 months after the December 2008 planning meetings, this is what was launched on an unsuspecting electorate.
Get ready to Tea Party!
April 15th. All across the country, citizens are standing up.
Here in D.C., what I'm covering in Lafayette Park, tomorrow morning, 1 million tea bags will be delivered by like 9 a.m.
Fox on Top of Teapot is full steam ahead.
Americans outraged over unfair and crippling taxes.
How to get involved in the hundreds of Tea Party protests.
Not happy with how the government is spending your tax money and taking from you in tax money. You're not alone.
Angry taxpayers are going online and attending tea parties.
How about you? Would you go to one of these tea parties?
You know, it is unlike anything we've ever seen before, at least in recent history.
Hundreds of thousands of outraged Americans may turn out.
We know of at least 500 cities.
Hundreds of towns and cities.
Hundreds of these tea parties.
Now we're talking about 500 cities tomorrow.
We are tracking 760 cities.
Look at all of them. That's where they're expected to be tomorrow.
No more evidence that they're just getting bigger and bigger.
It's touched a nerve in American
people at a ground, a grassroots level are fed up.
It is a grassroots movement.
The big question will be whether or not the mainstream media will cover it.
The mainstream media is not reporting on them.
Will the mainstream media cover these tea parties? I think they may be forced to.
I've seen the other networks kind of mention them,
yeah,
but in a mocking way.
Yeah, because they don't understand.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
So that's what we experienced in April of 2009, right? Now, being the political junkie that I am, I had seen this develop. I can literally say that I watched the buildup to this happen in real time. And by the time the April 15th Tea Party protests happened, I had written three articles attacking the legitimacy of the Tea Parties and made my first ever national television appearance and had this to say to my friend Stuart Varney on Fox News Your World.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show, Stuart. I appreciate it. I don't doubt that individuals, Democrats, Republicans, have strong feelings about taxes. But the fact is these tax day tea parties are a sham and a fraud.
Those were my first ever words on television, a short bit that concluded with, these tax day tea parties are a sham and a fraud. Boy, was I right from the get-go. In the time since I uttered those words, the Tea Party has gone from a group with a lot of support and a high favorability rating down to one whose favorable and unfavorable ratings closely mirror the Republican Party that spawned them. But they did a lot of damage in the meantime, including handing over control of the House of Representatives to the Republican Party in 2010. Now, at this point, you might be saying to yourself, that bit of recent history is great, Steve, but why are you talking about this now? I'm talking about this because I am sure, 100% sure, that the same folks who were meeting 4 years ago to plot a strategy to oppose President Obama and the Democrats have been meeting over the last couple of weeks, and the topic was the same as it was 4 years ago. The Republicans are as low in favorability as they were 4 years ago. The circumstances are eerily similar, and that makes me 100% certain that they are in the middle of plotting their next long-term dirty trick to derail President Obama's agenda. They're clearly up to something. A party that just got beaten like they did in November doesn't usually act as arrogantly as the Republicans have with regards to the fiscal cliff. I'll talk more about that later. So what might they do? Well, Grover Norquist, a couple of weeks ago, threatened that if taxes were raised on the wealthy, that, quote, Tea Party 2 would dwarf the success of the first Tea Party effort, end quote. Now, I don't know if the Republicans can recreate the success of the Tea Party, or whether they are planning some kind of other trick. But knowing exactly what the Republicans might do isn't necessary. What we need to do is to prepare for it, and to prepare for it, we need to do the same thing I would have recommended 4 years ago if we knew the Tea Party farce was going to happen in a couple of months, and that is we need to stay organized. We need to keep our level of awareness and involvement up. Keep reading the websites of Media Matters and Talking Points Memo. Keep involved with Organizing for America. Keep involved with MoveOn.org. Keep involved with Code Pink. Join your local Democratic Executive Committee and your local Democratic clubs. In short, keep a high-level involvement with all of the liberal and progressive organizations that you were involved with during the campaign. If you haven't been involved with one before, join them and get involved. Commit to working for one of your favorite liberal or progressive groups or your local Democratic Executive Committee once or twice a week. The last thing that I want to see is for us to get caught flat-footed again. It was absolutely maddening to see that fake grassroots insanity get the better of us last time. There's absolutely no reason for us to let it happen again. Whatever the Republicans are cooking up this time, we can beat that by organization, involvement, and commitment. The way to beat astroturfed fake grassroots is with real grassroots involvement. So pledge with me today to get involved and stay involved. Pretend the election campaign didn't end around 8 weeks ago. Make sure that no matter what sophisticated fraud they throw at us, this time we will be ready. You're listening to Making Sense with Steve Laser. And I'm going to move on now to the economy and the fiscal cliff. First, some statistics. This past Friday, the weekly jobless claims fell to a five-year low. The average number of people who sought unemployment benefits dropped to about 350,000. And most economists are expecting to see that around 150,000 net jobs were created in December, a number close to the monthly average for all of 2012. Now, at the same time that initial unemployment claims are falling and jobs are being created, banks are ending the year with their best profits since 2006 and are experiencing fewer failures at any time since the financial crisis struck in 2008, a year before President Obama was inaugurated. Now, I think it's all the more frustrating that we're seeing all of these positive results put in jeopardy by Republicans because they are holding out on the fiscal cliff to prevent a tax increase on the wealthiest Americans. That's the real business of what this fiscal cliff crisis is about for the GOP. President Obama wants to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans from 35% to 39.6%, and Republicans don't want to do that. It's that simple. Republicans want to save tax cuts for the rich so badly, they're willing to play chicken with the lives of middle class and poor people and with the broader economy. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would hold up the extension of unemployment benefits for people unless he gets his way with the fiscal cliff negotiations. Now, remember a theme that has run through a number of my shows. Republicans have stopped seeing America as their nationality. They've stopped being Americans in their minds, and they have adopted their party as their nationality. They feel allegiance to the Republican Party and to the wealthy that finance it, not to America. What else would be the reason for how they act? There is really strong evidence on all fronts that the economy is starting to build up some steam, and they're happy to sabotage that and to hold out for tax breaks for the rich. They're throwing the entire country under the bus for their party. CNN reported at around 2:30 p.m. today that the fiscal cliff talks hit a new major setback because Republicans are now saying They will refuse to accept any deal that does not include what it is called chained CPI. Now, CPI stands for Consumer Price Index. And in the context of the fiscal cliff discussions, it refers to Social Security being adjusted for consumer prices. It would change the way that Social Security benefits are adjusted for inflation, effectively meaning that Social Security recipients would receive less money over the years. I personally think that reducing Social Security or Medicare benefits are not the way to go as far as deficit reduction goes, but I'll talk more about that in a minute. CNN source in the Democratic Party said that Democrats are currently, quote, going outside their comfort zone, end quote, in these talks with regard to tax rates. Keeping tax rates in place for higher income households than the president wants. The source also said that Democrats are negotiating with Republicans on extending the current lower estate tax rate, a big issue for many Republicans as well as moderate Democrats. Now, I should also point out that President Obama today on Meet the Press talked about a willingness to discuss change CPI in the context of a broad agreement where taxes were raised on the folks who make above around $250,000 a year or perhaps $400,000 a year. In a response to a question from David Gregory, where Gregory asked President Obama why it is so hard for Republicans to say yes to him, the president said, you know, that's something that you're probably going to have to ask them because, you know, David, you follow this stuff pretty carefully. The offers that I've made to them have been so fair that a lot of Democrats get mad at me. I mean, I offered to make some significant changes to our entitlement programs in order to reduce the deficit. I offered not only $1 trillion in spending cuts over the next 10 years, but these changes would result in even more savings in the next 10 years and would solve our deficit problems for a decade. They say that their biggest priority is making sure that we deal with the deficit in a serious way, but the way they're behaving is that their only priority is making sure that tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans are protected. That seems to be their only overriding unifying theme. I agree with the president 100%. That's their only overriding theme. Now, a little later in the interview, in response to a question from Gregory regarding whether the president was willing to cut benefits to Medicare and Social Security, the president said, David, as you know, one of the proposals we made was something called chain CPI, which sounds really technical, but basically makes an adjustment in terms of how inflation is calculated on Social Security. Highly unpopular among Democrats, not something supported by AARP, but in pursuit of strengthening Social Security for the long term, I'm willing to make those decisions. What I'm not willing to do is to have the entire burden of deficit reduction rest on the shoulders of seniors, making students pay higher student loan rates, ruining our capacity to invest in things like basic research that help our economy grow. Those are the things I am not willing to do. Now, folks, I agree with the lion's share of how the president handled the fiscal cliff crisis, particularly his insistence that the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share of taxes and shoulder the biggest burden, or the only burden of any tax increases. But I got to tell you, I do not agree with the president on Social Security chain CPI. I think the offering of that is too much. And the fact is, even then, even with that offered to Republicans, they aren't willing to agree to a deal unless tax increases for the wealthy are taken off the table. You know, it's not worth negotiating with the Republicans on the fiscal cliff until after the changes take effect, and then Republicans are going to be desperate to cut taxes for as many people as they can to get them back to the Bush tax rates. Now, Mr. President, I applaud much of what you've done here, but take the chain CPI off the table. Wait until January 3rd, after the changes go into effect, and after Speaker Boehner has been reelected to the speakership and doesn't have to worry about a challenge from the right. On January 3rd, you will see Republicans willing to give up the store to make a deal. And that is what we should be holding out for, a real concession from Republicans. Now, I should note, folks, that in the last hour, there have been some reports from Washington that Republicans are giving up on their requirement to have a chain consumer price index on Social Security cost of living adjustments. At least that was coming out of Senate Republicans. I'm not sure if House Republicans have bought into that same thing. So we're going to have to wait and see. It's been my prediction, if you've been listening to the show for several weeks now, that we're not going to have any sort of deal until after the fiscal cliff changes go into effect, at which time, as I just said, Republicans are going to be in a really desperate position. That's, you know, as sad as it is, that's what we're going to have to wait for. You're listening to Making Sense with Steve Laser. And now, moving on to the gun argument that continues in the wake of the Sandy Hook shootings. Now, since last week's show, you've probably heard about it already, but two firefighters were killed in an ambush after a recently released ex-con set a fire with the express intent to lure firefighters within range of the weapons he had obtained. On Tuesday, Christmas Day, Memphis police say that a 10-year-old boy died from what they believe was an accidental shooting. An AP report said that police spokeswoman Karen Rudolph said officers received a call around 1:15 p.m. on Tuesday about a shooting at a local residence. When they arrived, they discovered a young boy had been shot. The child was transported to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. Additionally, in the last week, a Memphis father has been charged after his 4-year-old son fatally shot his 2-year-old brother with a gun that he found in the home. The father had left a loaded handgun lying around. Now, you may think that is crazy, but many of the gun rights folks who argue with me write to me to tell me they've always got a gun loaded and ready that they can quickly access in the event someone breaks into their house to rob or harm them. Nor is it much better if the gun is locked up, as, you know, that's usually the next argument that you hear from gun enthusiasts. I've always got my gun locked up, but I can unlock it, I can take it out, and I'm ready when a moment's notice. Well, earlier this month, a 7-year-old boy shot his 8-year-old sister after finding the key to a safe where their parents' guns were kept. The 7-year-old even had to assemble a disassembled gun after finding it in order to use it. Typing the word shooting in a Google News search today yields stories of 9 separate shootings in the last 24 hours just on the front first page of that search. That's part of what we need to consider in the wake of Sandy Hook. There is a massive level of gun violence in this country to which we have become so desensitized we just gloss right over most reports of it in the news. That's one of the biggest problems. Folks, stop being desensitized to everyday gun violence. That's the first thing that we have to do to start changing things. As horrific as it was, I am telling you now, as I have on my last couple of shows, Sandy Hook is not going to be enough to force any kind of meaningful change. It's going to take more. It's going to take a constant reminding people of all of the carnage that happens on a daily basis in this country. And we're going to have to juxtapose that awareness with an awareness that gun control does work and has worked. For instance, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced Friday that New York City is projected to end 2012 with the fewest murders on record, and that shootings will hit an 18-year low in the city. There were 414 murders in New York City in 2012 so far, and that is the lowest number since records started being kept back in 1963. Lower than 1963. Compare the 414 murders in 2012 with a high of 2,245 in 1990. Some people don't know this, but New York is the safest of the big cities in America. As a matter of fact, it's consistently in the top 10 over the last 10 years. It's consistently in the top 10 safest of any cities in the U.S. of over 100,000 people in terms of crime rate. As Bloomberg put it, the fact that the safest big city in America is safer than ever is a testament to the hard work and determination of the men and women who put their lives on the line for us every day, and it also reflects our commitment to doing everything possible to stop gun violence. But you know what, folks? It's hard keeping guns out of big cities, even with gun control laws in those cities. Why? Because many big cities are short drives away from places that have lax gun control laws. That's the problem. Philadelphia, for instance, has strict gun control laws, but it's part of the state of Pennsylvania that has very lax laws regarding gun control. All it takes is to go outside the city limits, you buy your gun under the easy rules that the state has, and then you drive your guns back into the city, and those guns become part of the gun violence in that city. Chicago, which has an exploding crime rate, faces a problem of guns brought in from Indiana and Iowa. All of this is why we need better gun control laws at the state and federal level. It's going to take work to make that happen, though. And part of that work is to keep raising the awareness of everyday gun violence. Polls show how much work we have to do. A Gallup poll released on Thursday only showed majority support in this country for banning high-capacity gun clips of over 10 rounds. 51% of Americans were opposed to a ban on semi-automatic weapons. 51% are opposed. And 74% say they oppose a ban on handguns. Now, here's where the contradictions come in. It's very similar to the contradictions we see in taxes, right? Nearly 60% of the people polled by Gallup said that they supported some kind of increased gun control. But when asked about specifics, the only measure a majority supported was the banning of high-capacity clips, over 10. Folks, a person can bring 3 or 4 loaded semi-automatic handguns with 10-round clips into a large gathering of children and cause carnage equal to what we saw at Sandy Hook. Now, I'm in favor of the ban on large capacity magazines, but let's face it, it's only a token gesture. That's not what is going to stop these mass murders of people. That's why I say that meaningful gun control is going to take a lot of awareness raising and, unfortunately, a lot more carnage before it happens. This is something that's frustrating for people in the inner cities. I hear a lot of this. Very frustrating for particularly people of color in the inner cities because they've been experiencing this firsthand for decades, and they've been desperately trying to raise awareness about it. So here's what we do. Take the important step, and this is for everyone who hears this show. Take the step, at least a couple of days of work, and go to Google, click on the news menu tab at the top, and then in the search field, type the word shooting, and click the little blue magnifying glass button, and check out the results. Do this a couple of times a week, and post at least 1 or 2 of the shooting articles of the last 24 hours on your Facebook or Twitter page, or mail it to your friends. Get as many other people that you know to do the same. I'm going to repeat that. At least once or twice a week, go to Google, click on the news section, do a search on shooting, and post on your Facebook or Twitter page, or email to your friends, at least 2 of the shooting articles that have appeared on Google News over the past 24 hours, and get as many other people that you know to do the same thing. I did it for the first time today. If you check out my Facebook page or my blog, you'll see I did that for the first time today. If enough of us do this simple thing, use the power of social media. If enough of us do it, I promise you, we'll be on the short road to meaningful gun control in this country. Finally, it's time for the weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and pundits who made terrific sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. This week, the Reverend Al Sharpton deserves to be front and center in our Hall of Fame for making terrific sense in this particular segment on the fiscal cliff. Let's listen.
This is real. It's money they need to feed their families. Money used to get to work, maybe to save for college. And what about the Americans struggling to find work? 2 million people will lose unemployment benefits. 2 million Americans will be left to suffer. And why? Because Speaker Boehner can't get his caucus in line, and they refuse to raise taxes on the top earners. Republicans want to play politics, but this isn't a game, and they're playing with people's lives. You know, when you look, Maria, at the fact that they turned down Speaker Boehner's plan, a plan that would raise taxes on just 0.3% of households. Grover Norquist even said it did not violate his tax pledge, and it cut from food stamps, Medicaid, and health care. They voted that down. How do these people, I'm talking about the members of Congress, that are on the right wing, far right, that voted this down, and they go home to Christmas singing all kinds of carols. How do you do that and vote to do this to the people that are the most vulnerable, to protect people that it wouldn't bother at all to pay their fair share?
Reverend Al got it exactly right. That's what the Republicans and their more rabid supporters keep missing. They're hurting real people with their games and dysfunction on the fiscal cliff. Thank you, Reverend Al, for putting it in the inimitable way that you frame things. Now, making the Hall of Shame this week for absolutely infamous nonsense, this week it was absolutely no contest. Our Hall of Shame award for making crazy nonsense goes to Father Piero Corsi in Liguria, Italy. Father Corsi posted his annual Christmas bulletin onto Facebook a few weeks ago. So far, so good, right? What could be so bad about that? Well, the title of the flyer was Women and Femicide, Healthy Self-Criticism. How often do they provoke? And it went on to suggest that victims of domestic and sexual violence should question if they were themselves to blame for the incident. And that wasn't all. Further on the flyer, Father Corsi said, the fact is that women are increasingly provocative, they become arrogant, they believe themselves to be self-sufficient and end up exacerbating the situation. Children are abandoned to their own devices, homes are dirty, meals are cold or fast food, clothes are filthy. End quote. So Father Corsi, let's get this straight. Women who are murdered or who are raped or experience domestic violence should all question whether they're at fault for their attacks. And the reason they're at fault for those attacks is because women are self-sufficient and are serving cold food for their families and not adequately laundering clothes? Folks, I got to tell you, garbage like this is why I created this part of the show. In fact, in the future, when someone asks for an example of the kinds of things that I highlight in the nonsense portion of my show, Father Corsi's crazy and offensive Christmas flyer is exactly the example that I'm going to offer. Yes, Father Corsi, that's how bad the things are that you said. You're my poster boy for nonsense. That's all I have for this evening. Thank you all for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Lazor will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time this Sunday, January 6th. Until then, have a great rest of your evening, a great week, and a happy new year.